Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. When you think of the people who sparked change during the civil rights movement, you might think of Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks. You probably don't think of Sergeant Isaac Woodard. But a new book tells the forgotten story of how he changed the course of civil rights. It's called Unexampled Courage: The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Wattis Waring. We spoke with the author, active federal judge Richard Gergel. He began by telling us who Sergeant Woodard was and what exactly happened on February 12, 1946.
He was returning home to rural South Carolina after being discharged from the Army, literally on the day of his discharge, February 12, 1946. And he got into a dispute with a Greyhound bus driver about a restroom break. And the bus driver spoke to him very discourteously. And he said, "Speak to me like I'm a man. I'm a man just like you." Well, in rural South, 1946, that was not acceptable behavior for a black man, even one who wore the nation's uniform.
And who was in uniform at
the
moment,
we should say. He was in his dress uniform. And at the next stop in Batesburg, South Carolina, the bus driver went to the local police, had him removed and arrested. And while in police custody, he was beaten and blinded. And that outrageous event eventually came to the attention of President Truman, who, among other things, prompted the criminal prosecution by the federal government of the police chief, Linwood Shaw, for the blinding of Isaac Woodard. That trial was before Judge J. Wattis Waring, United States District Judge, and a jury of 12 white men acquitted the officer after 28 minutes of deliberations. That outcome so outraged and struck the conscience of the presiding judge, J. Wattis Waring, that he was forever transformed and within a matter of months began issuing landmark civil rights decisions that would eventually lead to Brown versus Board of Education. So it's these are two fascinating characters.
That's a great synopsis for us. But this is a chapter of history that's been largely forgotten. You presided in the same courthouse as Judge Waring, and you didn't know the history until you embarked on this journey.
Correct. I knew, of course, that Judge Waring had been a pioneering judge in the area of civil rights. He was, in 1947, there was no one in the South like him. So a question that many journalists asked him at the era, he was a national figure, what changed you? And he would always say, "While on the bench, I developed a passion for justice." Now, that was a very nice statement, but it doesn't tell us what actually changed him. And as I dug into his personal history, I focused upon this trial. And as I developed this hypothesis that it was this trial that transformed him, I learned a great deal about the blinding of Isaac Woodard, and I came to appreciate just why it would inspire him and why it would inspire Harry Truman to take bold steps in the advancement of civil rights.
Well, could you read us a little bit of your book? This is a passage on the 73rd page that sort of gets at what you're just talking about, this impact on President Truman, who up until this moment, we should say, has been sort of squishy on whether he really wants to take on civil rights as a big issue.
Right. Let me just give a little bit of background that Harry Truman, as a senator from Missouri, had a very positive civil rights record. He was considered a friend of civil rights. But as president, he had been told by his staff, as a practical matter, there was nothing he could do. And there was a great fear that he would alienate the segregationists, because the Democratic Party in the South, of course, was an all-white party at the time and really was the branch of the party most loyal to the Democratic National ticket. So you couldn't alienate the segregationists was the sort of party line. But on the other hand, you had this compelling moral need to address with the issues of racial justice. So this meeting on September 19 followed a series of these events involving African-American veterans returning home and suffering violence. So I read, "The civil rights leaders opened the September 19 meeting by imploring Truman to take vigorous action against lynch mobs and other racially motivated violence across the South. They urged the president to call Congress into special session to adopt federal anti-lynching legislation. After listening sympathetically, Truman told them, 'Everyone seems to believe the president by himself can do anything he wishes to on such matters as this. But the president is helpless unless he is backed by public opinion.' Truman's closest ally in the room, Walter White, sensed that the president did not appreciate the gravity of the situation. Rather than continuing the discussion on proposals for presidential action, he began sharing with Truman in graphic detail the beating and blinding of Isaac Woodard. As the story unfolded, Truman sat riveted and became visibly agitated and angered. casting his staff's advice aside, an obviously distressed president responded, "My God, I had no idea it was as terrible as that. We have got to do something." Following that meeting, one day later, he writes a letter to his attorney general, and he says the time for action has now arrived. Justice Department was not prosecuting cases such as this, a white police officer victimizing an African-American citizen. And he further said, it is time for us to deal with the root causes of these problems. Well, out of that letter, which landed over the Justice Department like a bombshell, the Justice Department filed criminal charges against Linwood Shull, the police chief of Batesburg, South Carolina, for the beating and blinding of Isaac Woodard. And meanwhile, the Justice Department prepared the papers for the appointment of the Presidential Commission on Civil Rights. And out of that comes Executive Order 9981, ordering the immediate integration of the armed forces.
How much credit does Sergeant Woodard deserve for prompting that tangible action by the president?
Well, David McCullough, Harry Truman's wonderful biographer, said that the Isaac Woodard event affected Harry Truman like statistics never did. It was just something about that story of the soldier in uniform, battlefield decorated, on the day of his discharge, blinded. What an act of injustice and lack of appreciation for the service to this nation.
I found the New York Times report on this trial from 1946. This is on the acquittal, and I'll just read the lead paragraph. It's basically just a recitation of facts, but it captures so neatly what you're describing. The dateline is Columbia, South Carolina. This is November 5th of 1946. After deliberating 30 minutes, an all-white federal court jury tonight cleared Linwood L. Shull, chief of police of Batesburg, South Carolina, of a charge of violating the civil rights of Isaac Woodward of the Bronx, New York. I'll point out that Woodward is a typo in there. They didn't get the
constant,
name.
Constant, by the way, right. That permeates much of the historic record, misnaming him, including the prosecutor misnamed him in the opening charge, which outraged the NAACP lawyers who were observing the trial, that they could never even get his name straight. It was a deeply flawed prosecution.
Including not submitting medical records, for example, that might have supported Woodard's account. Because remember, the police chief in this case had claimed to have only struck Woodard one time, which didn't add up when you saw that his eyes had been put out by a billy club.
Right. The account of Isaac Woodard and the account of the police chief on how he was blinded were markedly different. Isaac Woodard said that the blackjack, the end of it was jammed into each eye. That's how you had bilateral blindness. And the police officer says, I hit him once, and if I blinded him, boy, I didn't mean that to happen. Well, they never got the medical record to discern what actually happened and the nature of his injuries. I obtained the medical record from the Veterans Administration. It wasn't easy to get, but we got it. And I gave that information to a forensic pathologist who told me there was no question that Isaac Woodard's account was correct and the account of the police chief was medically impossible. And I asked my forensic pathologist, I said, are you using techniques and knowledge that exist today but not in 1946? She says, oh, no, this was easily discernible in 1946 if someone had bothered to check it.
So the injustice of this trial has a profound impact on Judge Gergel, and I'm hoping that—
Judge Waring.
Judge Waring. I'm sorry. You are Judge
Gergel. I am Judge Gergel.
Judge Gergel, could you read a little bit from your book about this? I direct you to 132nd page. This is actually the third reading in your packet.
Yes.
I'm throwing you for a loop here.
And, I'm fine.
But it really gives us a sense of not only the impact on Judge Waring, but also on his wife.
Very important part of the story.
Yeah. So if you would pick us up there.
Judge Waring would later describe the Shull trial as his wife's baptism in racial prejudice and his own baptism of fire. It was a transformative event in the life of the Warings, causing them to see and sense the world around them in a fundamentally different way. The world of Jim Crow now suddenly came into focus. For the first time in his 66 years, Waitis Waring began to doubt his basic assumptions about the Southern way of life. Responding to the question of Elizabeth's friend, what are we going to do about it, the Warings began a period of serious study and reflection on the issues of race in America and a federal judge's personal responsibility to uphold the rule of law. This period of study and introspection would take Waitis Waring on a journey in which he would ultimately resolve that it was his sworn duty to boldly and forthrightly confront racial injustice, whatever the personal consequences.
And Judge Gergel, give us a sense of what a deep transformation this is for a person like Judge Waring. I mean, he's the son of a Confederate soldier. He grows up.
Now, people are surprised. They said, literally, the guy was an eighth-generation Charlestonian. Multiple generations of his ancestors were slaveholders. He was supported for his federal appointment by Cotton Ed Smith, one of the most virulent racists in the history of the United States Senate. But this was an important period in American history. The country is at war, a war promoted on fighting racial hatred and intolerance with the Nazis. And some people, you know, would look around and say, well, you know, we're not doing that good ourselves here in the United States. So this was this very dynamic moment. And as these African-American soldiers, 900,000 strong, returned to the United States, it put the country in a great moral dilemma. And Wade S. Waring was receptive to hearing it. He was different from others. I mean, he made a journey that no other federal judge had made at the time.
How should history look back, though, at figures like Judge Waring? I mean, you see sort of this mixed bag that his life was. And I think this is something that people are wrestling with a lot today, I mean, certainly in a high-profile way about Confederate statues and the like, but it may be also about our founding fathers. I mean, people who have very mixed stances over the course of their lives on race relations, but they also evolve and grow. They're imperfect. They're flawed. I mean, how do we reconcile that when we look back decades later?
First of all, we need to evaluate people in their own time, right? And Wade S. Waring is a transformative figure in American history. And he personally also developed deep personal relationships with African Americans in the 1950s at a time that was highly unusual. So he went on a journey that today he would look like a pretty typical person with, you know, with real sincere relationships across racial lines. But in 1947, there was no one like Wade S. Waring in the South.
Let me ask you a bit about the Briggs case now. I mean, this becomes an important precedent for Brown versus Board of Education later, 3 years later in 1954. This is a case in which Waring was in the minority. So explain the importance of his dissent in this school segregation case in 1951.
The NAACP had been trying to find a path within a very hostile judicial climate to advance the cause of civil rights. The worst of those cases, of course, was Plessy versus Ferguson, which established the principle of separate but equal. And the NAACP decided to turn that doctrine against the segregationists because the real practice was separate and unequal. So they would bring lawsuits challenging unequal opportunities, but it was somewhat controversial because every time they used Plessy as a sword against segregationists, they were reinforcing that doctrine. And there was a thought that that doctrine was very harmful and permanently ensconced African-Americans in inferior status. So Judge Waring, he felt like he was getting towards the end of his career. He thought that Plessy was legally, historically, and morally wrong. And he wanted to be part of solving this problem before he retired. And he had a case on his docket called Briggs versus Elliott from Somerton, South Carolina, a very rural, impoverished district. And Thurgood Marshall was the lawyer for the plaintiffs, and the case sought to provide equal educational opportunities in this profoundly unequal school district. And it was only a matter of trying the case for a couple of days, and the plaintiffs were going to win. Thurgood Marshall arrives at the federal courthouse in late 1950 for what is called a pretrial conference. I have him before every case. And when he arrives, Marshall is told by Judge Waring, bring me a frontal challenge to school segregation. Don't bring me any more separate and equal cases. Marshall says to him, because the NAACP was in the midst of a debate about how to do this, he says, Your Honor, it's on our agenda, it's just not tonight. Pretty cool response. This is not the case, this is not the time. Waring says, Thurgood, it is the case, it is the time. In another part of that conversation, Marshall says, Judge, be practical. You will be reversed by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals if you rule that segregation is unlawful. He says, we won't go to the Fourth Circuit because I'm going to arrange for the convening of a three-judge panel, because if you challenge school segregation, it requires a three-judge panel as a challenge to a state law, constitutionality of a state law. Marshall said, well, Judge, we'll lose 2-1. He says, exactly, but you then automatically go into the docket of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he says, Thurgood, that's where you want to be. Marshall leaves the room shocked, as I'm sure any lawyer would be that a judge would so directly direct him how to act. And they then go into the very public pretrial conference, which is being covered by reporters. And Waring says, Mr. Marshall, are you prepared to confront school segregation? He says, yes, sir, I am. He says, I'm going to allow you to dismiss this lawsuit and refile it. He did. And out of that came the first frontal challenge to public school segregation in American history. It would eventually be one of the five cases that make up Brown versus Board of Education. And it was the first case tried, the first case filed. Wade S. Waring dissented in that case, and he fashioned a theory about how why the separate and equal doctrine made no sense, because all segregation was per se inequality and per se unconstitutional. That language then is used 3 years later in the greatest case in American history, Brown versus Board of Education.
And it's within that dissent in 1951 that Judge Waring praises the plaintiffs for their unexampled courage. And
right.
that's where that phrase comes from.
The plaintiffs are targeted for retaliation. The level of their courage is just extraordinary.
And it's a phrase that could certainly be applied to Sergeant Isaac Woodard. So
Sergeant Woodard, Harry Truman, Judge Waring, Thurgood Marshall. I mean, this is a story of unexampled courage.
In the moments we have left, could you describe what else we know about the rest of Sergeant Woodard's life? I mean, he's blinded now at a young age, at 26, and how does he live out the rest of his days?
Well, his wife quickly let him know she was not interested in maintaining a relationship with a blinded husband. So he went to the home of his parents in the Bronx, and he lived in obscurity. I mean, nobody remembered who he was. He was very famous in 1946. This was a well-known story. But he soon faded into obscurity. And the tragic part of this is he never knew his impact on Harry Truman or Judge Waring or his impact on American history.
Judge Gergel, before I let you go, I have to ask you about the impact of this research and perhaps the example of Judge Waring on your own work. I mean, you're probably best known to our listeners and the public for presiding over the Dylann Roof trial. Dylann Roof, of course, being the white supremacist who killed the Charleston Nine at that church in South Carolina. I mean, what examples can you draw from perhaps Judge Waring or other things that you've taken in your work and apply it in your own work today on the bench?
Well, Cal, I'm sure you understand I don't comment about any of my cases. But let me just say generally that Judge Waring is an inspiration to all judges. One of my most popular audiences involve judges, and they find great inspiration in it because it just tells us that our duty is to uphold the rule of law, to uphold the ideals of the United States Constitution. It's a sacred duty, and Judge Waring is just an extraordinary example and a model for all of us.
That's Judge Richard Gergel. He's a U.S. District Court judge in South Carolina and the author of Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Wattis Waring. Judge Gergel, thank you so much for your
time. Pleasure to be here.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.